If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
President Trump spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning. Specifically, are you going to finish that?
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth has interviews with authors Marlon James and Claire Adam. Marlon and Claire also both took a few more bonus questions backstage, which you'll hear after their interviews. But first, a closer look.
It seems like President Trump is freaking out about the Democrats running for president. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump spoke this morning to religious leaders at the National Prayer Breakfast. It's always a slightly awkward situation for a president who's been married 3 times, paid hush money to a porn star, and has probably, at best, skimmed the Bible.
And as you all know, God set a fire to a bush so he could collect the insurance money and build a casino. It was smart. It was a smart move.
For example, Trump mentioned the problem of human trafficking, and here is his expert diagnosis on what's causing it.
Together, we will end the scourge of modern-day slavery that, because of the internet, is at levels that nobody can believe. The internet came along, and some good things happened, but some very bad things happened.
Oh, really, Dr. Science? That's your expert opinion? The internet came along and some good things happened and some bad things happened? One of the good things about the internet is you can Google how to pronounce the word scourge.
Scourge.
Trump then laid out what I guess you could say is his thesis statement for America, the thing that makes our country great. Reagan called it the shining city on a hill, and Obama said America's a place where you can write your own destiny. And now here are President Trump's thoughts on what makes America great.
America's potential is unlimited because our extraordinary people are just something that is number one.
Soaring words. Just soaring words. He's like a guy on a date getting lines fed to him through an earpiece and the feed cut out.
You have beautiful eyes and your nose. Well, I mean, you know, it's your nose, but it's a... You got a real great honker.
Trump was trying to live up to the theme of unity he set out in his State of the Union address Tuesday. As we all know, he's incapable of that. Trump always needs something to scare people about, and in his speech on Tuesday, he landed on a new target, warning that Democrats would turn America into a socialist country. And it prompted a few scattered reactions from Republicans in the audience.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country.
Well, guys, you did it. You stopped socialism by booing it. It reminds me of Ronald Reagan's famous line, "Mr. Gorbachev, boo this wall." At least they're making real proposals like Medicare for All. You guys stole your best political argument from Statler and Waldorf.
Boo! Boo!
And then... then, of course, the camera caught the reaction of self-described Democratic socialist Bernie Sanders after Trump vowed to stop socialism from taking root in America.
America was founded on liberty and independence and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
So, turns out Statler was in the audience. I mean, that's a real classic Bernie face there. That's the face Bernie makes when he finds out the restaurant charges for bread.
Bread is supposed to be free! Bread a care for all!
I hope you're applauding for the writer who told me bread a care for all wouldn't work. And then yesterday, in an interview on CNBC, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin doubled down on Trump's line about socialism, although the way he said it left some people scratching their heads.
The good news is the U.S. economy is doing terrific. We continue to have very strong jobs numbers. I think you've just begun to see the beginning of tax reform. I think you're going to see that kick in a lot again. And as the president talked about last night, his economic program is working. We're not going back to socialism.
Now, when he says going back, he's probably referring to President Obama, who was many things, but he was not a socialist. I mean, first of all, look at the way he dresses now. Looks like a high-powered sports agent. LeBron, baby, you're crushing it. The minute he left the White House, he got cast in a recurring role on Ballers. And yet, while he was whining about socialism in public, Trump was also claiming in private that he had predicted the success of one of the most famous self-described Democratic socialists of the new Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Trump met news anchors hours before his speech and claimed that he was among the first to spot her political talent and said he had predicted her primary upset last year. Trump said he knew Ocasio-Cortez had it, meaning star power. Oh, really? You predicted that one of the most charismatic and internet-famous politicians in the country had star power? I wonder who else he brags about. You know who I think is going places? Tom Hanks. Trump thinks he's good at spotting star power because he thinks he has star power. But when people say Trump has it, that's not what they mean. I'm sorry, but it looks like you have it. And it has gone straight to your brain. Scaremongering about socialism might have worked a few years ago, but it's lost its punch now that Republicans have used it over and over and over again. Just take last year's midterm elections. Trump went to Wisconsin, a state he won in 2016, to campaign against Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. And he tried to warn the crowd that Baldwin would support socialized medicine, although he claimed he was trying to be nice about it.
Leah's radical far-left opponent is Tammy Baldwin, who wants a socialist takeover of healthcare. You know, I'm trying to say that very nicely. I'm trying to... See, normally I'd scream, they want a socialist takeover. Now I say, wants a socialist takeover of healthcare. I'm trying to be nice.
It's so jarring when he tells people he's pretending to be nice. It's like if Robert De Niro looked into the camera halfway through a movie and said, I'm not really in the mafia, I'm pretending. No, this is real. And the attack didn't work. Baldwin ended up winning a race by 10 points. But if you thought billionaire Donald Trump would be the least effective messenger against the supposed dangers of socialized medicine, you'd be wrong. Because on Tuesday, Fox Business News actually found someone who was even worse at it, Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson. Fox had him on for some reason, and instead of asking about something he's qualified to talk about, like duck calls or how to dress if you want to blend into a marsh, they asked him about health care policy, and he ended up going on an insane rant about Senator Kamala Harris's proposal to eliminate private health insurance. Even the Fox anchor who invited him on was flustered by how crazy his answers were.
We have been given, contrary to what Kamala Harris said, she says, elect me and everything's free. Look, everybody can have their own health care. The government's going to finance the whole thing. What I'm saying is that Kamala I already have health care. It's given to me by God, eternal health care. I'm guaranteed to be raised from the dead. I have life and immortality given to me by God through Jesus Christ.
But people get sick on earth in human form. So
and they get,
you advise...
The temporary reprieve is not worth it.
The anchor actually had to say, people get sick on earth in human form. I mean, I'm assuming after you have to say that to a guest, your next stop is at your producer's office to say, maybe no more Woods people? Also, it's so crazy seeing a guy say that with a stock ticker underneath him. Did you get any stock tips today? No, but I heard Phil Robertson's gonna live forever. And by the way, lest you think Fox sought out the opinion of a regular guy, Hillbilly Gandalf here reportedly has a net worth of $15 million. Plus an extra 38 cents if he ever combs out his beard.
Ooh.
And yet somehow the fever dream got weirder from there because Robertson went on to claim that people don't need health care at all and that he was living proof.
I'm telling her I have eternal health care and it's free. Doctors can give you a little temporary reprieve, right, but they cannot save you from physical death. The doctors who treat you, they die too.
Jesus. But you're not dismissing that people need health care, right? It's just who...
I didn't have health care for 50 years.
Well, you look great. The reason they're all freaking out about Medicare for All is because they know it makes basic sense to people. Most people don't care whether it's called socialism or capitalism or whatever. They just know it's inherently unfair for mega-billionaires to hoard their wealth while millions of Americans don't even have health care. Ocasio-Cortez made that point in an interview recently, and a Fox News guest mocked her for it.
A system that allows billionaires to exist when there are parts of Alabama where people are still getting ringworm because they don't have access to public health is wrong.
She's saying, Mark, that basically she doesn't want the kind of poverty that leads to lack of health care to exist when people are, you know, allowed to have billions of dollars and be fat cats, essentially.
Well, first of all, I mean, the fact is ringworm isn't deadly. People get ringworm, you know, it's like foot fungus.
We know ringworm isn't deadly. For some people, it's jewelry.
Will you take this ring and be my swamp bride? I'm never gonna die. You can be on my health insurance. I get it from Jesus.
Now, there is a reason. A reason these guys are freaking out about Medicare for All and why most Democrats running for president are for it. It just makes basic sense to people. Everyone deserves health care for one very simple reason, and that is...
Christ. People get sick on earth in human form.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest tonight is an award-winning author. His last book, A Brief History of Seven Killings, won the prestigious Man Booker Prize. His new novel, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, is on stands now. Please welcome back to the show, Marlon James, everyone. How are you?
You know what? I'm doing very well. The last time I came here, I won the Booker Prize.
Yes.
I bought some Mega Millions.
You did?
Yeah.
So. Oh, for this time, you think it's going to be the same thing. It's just good luck to see me.
I need a New York house.
You need a New York, Well, you might need to buy a couple Mega Millions. usually one lottery winning will not buy you a house in New York. But you were here in 2015. Mm-hmm. We talked about your book. You won the Man Booker Prize. Yeah. Did that, was that you posted about it here? I did not know what it looked like until I saw it on your Instagram. There you see there, and you wrote, holy which I think is about right. And does that, you know... That's a big deal in the literary world. Did it change your life right away?
Well, it did, because then any rude Facebook post I made became headlines.
Oh, I gotcha.
I went to India, and the whole time I was tweeting and Facebooking about how bad the airport was. And by the time I landed, it was Man Booker Prize winner insults India.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's
It was going on for the whole week. The best one was at the end when somebody asked me, how am I feeling about Jaipur, I'm saying, I'm so overwhelmed by India. And the thing is, Marlon James is overwhelmed by India. And it seems he's changed his mind about India and the Indians. I'm like, I'm just talking about your airport.
Yeah. I mean, New York, if we took it personally, everybody talked about LaGuardia, none of us could live here another day.
Yeah, they sued the festival.
I
was
really?
I was going to go to another festival, and they were like, you might want to sit that one out for a year.
Wow, all right. Well, hopefully you'll be welcome back in India for your next book. So this is the first of a trilogy.
Yeah.
This is already a hefty book. Do you go into knowing that you were going to write, because this is wonderful, but it's long. Do you know when you embarked? Did you say this is going to be a three-book story?
I knew it was a three-book story when I was talking to somebody about this TV show, The Affair.
Okay. That's a Showtime show, The Affair?
Yeah, I actually haven't seen yet.
You haven't seen it yet? Okay.
It was hugely influential. It was a director, and she was talking to me about it and saying, this is a great idea for a TV show. And I was like, forget a TV show. It's a great idea for a trilogy. Because in a lot of African storytelling, unlike storytelling in the West, it's the trickster who's telling a story. So you already know you can't quite believe it. So if I put out three books, which is three different characters telling the same story, by the way, I'm not going to tell the reader which one to believe. They're going to have to choose after a few years.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to explode all over Reddit.
This is, some people have called this, because you, as you mentioned, this deals with African folklore, and some people have referred to it as a sort of an African Game of Thrones, but that actually came from something you said.
You know, I said it as a kind of a joke. I was talking to one of your writers backstage. It seems I said it here.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I said it in this magazine, which I honestly didn't think anybody read.
Okay.
It turns out all the people who read it are in media.
Okay.
And it got so bad that Jar Jar Martin sent me an email.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Like a nice email?
It was a really nice email.
Good.
He's, I heard you're written an African version of my book that sounds delightful. and then he invited me out to his bookstore.
Oh,
so,
that's great.
Yeah, so I did what every writer would do. I said, so can I get a blurb?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you get him to blurb? No, he wouldn't blurb you.
I mean, maybe he just was busy.
He was probably busy.
Winds of Winter.
I got to be honest. With all the writing he needs to do, I don't want him to waste any time. If I heard he was like, oh, I was trying to, but I had to read Marlon's book to blurb him.
His big 620-page opus, no.
I will say one of the things that I'm going to take away from this is you keep saying things either in interviews or on Facebook and forgetting that people are actually listening to you, and you have to be a little bit more careful. Yeah.
Yeah.
You had to do, obviously, I'm guessing at least, a ton of research in reading this.
Yeah.
How do you even go about, how many years does it take to research a book that is going to be this specific?
Well, I mean, it took 2 years of research, meaning it took 2 years of my assistant, Jeff, to do all the research.
Okay, gotcha. So wow. This was a Jeff job?
Yeah.
So what do you do while Jeff's doing the research?
You know what? I sit down and I think.
Okay.
I think very hard. But honestly, I also did quite a bit of it. Because, I mean, I was researching for 2 years, meaning Jeff was researching it for 2 years before I even wrote Our Life, because I didn't know whose story it was.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, this is what happens with stories for me. I am usually talking to somebody, usually a female friend. I get all my ideas from women.
Not a bad way to go.
No, and there was just something, I go, that's it. And when, when my friend said, the whole idea about The Affair, and I go, that was it. But until then, I didn't know. And I sat around in my office for a good year, and the idea came the week before school started. So I was like, great, I can write the book. No, I got to teach.
Yeah. and now... have you already moved on to the second? Is that possible?
Yeah, I've begun with the second. I think, of course, the person who tells book two is kind of the villain of book one.
Okay.
So people are already having these emotional attachments to characters. I'm like, you might regret that.
All right. I love the switching of perspective. Yeah. I know you go to book signings where people come to have you sign their books, but I heard you were late to one of them because you actually got caught up trying to get one of your books signed.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of comics. I'm a huge fan of Hellboy.
Same here. Great, a fantastic book.
And it was an LA book fair, and I had my own line I had my own book signing, but Mike Mignola is like right there. And I'm in this line that's like half a mile long. And I'm not leaving because I have 4 stacks of Hellboy. He won't remember any of this. I'm not leaving because I came all the way from Jamaica with a
stack of Hellboy. They should have run your line up, like, sort of perpendicular to his line. Yeah. They should have thought this through.
Yeah.
Now that people have read the book, mm-hmm. you can get feedback. Do you like those moments where people can come up to you and tell you things about your book, or are there
not
things
really,
you dread?
No,
you don't like people. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's you know, I'd be at a reading and it would be great, and then you always have the, I don't have a question, just a comment. And I'd be like, you know what? You can comment forever backstage.
Wow. There
yeah,
you
I'm
go.
Pretty good at it now.
You're pretty good. You can shut it down?
I can shut it down.
That's good. Well, I'm very, I'm just thrilled that you have another one coming. And I really enjoyed this. And in general, it's just wonderful having you back on the show. Thanks
so much. It's so great
for
to be back.
Carlin James, everybody. Black Leopard, Red Wolf, and Available Now, wherever books are sold.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with Marlon James. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
We spoke briefly on the phone about this, but I mentioned mm-hmm. when I started the book, there's an index at the beginning of mm-hmm. characters. Mm-hmm. How many characters would you say are listed
on that? Oh, my God. I've lost count. Certainly over 100.
And it was a little intimidating for me. I just skipped right through it. I decided yeah. I'm not even going to embark upon this. I'm just going to get going mm-hmm. because I think it will be too difficult.
Yeah. You don't really have to read a cast of characters. It's only for if people forget. Mm-hmm. If you reach somewhere and you're like, Sogolan, who's that again? And you just flip to the... And that's how I do it with Soana, because characters are going to appear anyway. And hopefully they'll leave a kind of mark. You know, and it's, I mean, it's so many characters, so many of them minor. It's really more of a reference than anything.
How did you keep track of not only the characters, mm-hmm. but the places and the timelines for each?
Oh, I had to have notebooks and charts on the wall. My walls were covered in post-its, different colors for different characters. And then notebooks on the floor. I mean, notebooks after notebooks, I'll draw diagrams and columns. Because, yeah, I'm writing, you know, a lot of characters, and I don't want to play favorites, or it would be an entire novel about a giant.
Ogo?
Yeah, I have a novel about the Ogo. Not that he's my favorite, but... but, yeah, that's how I kept track, or I would go crazy.
I also found it was super interesting the way that you talk about the theme of change mm-hmm. in the book. There's obviously characters that shapeshift.
Right.
But also, for example, like Leopard, the tracker loves him but also mm-hmm. hates him.
Mm-hmm.
And was that something that you came to while you were writing, or was that something you set out to do from the top?
It's something I came to while I was writing, because a lot of that I didn't know. I think, well, I know for me when I'm writing characters, I have to give them space to become people. And then people evolve, people change, people surprise, people disappoint. People, you know, for whatever reason, turn into people we might love or people we don't like anymore. And that was very important for me, that the characters evolve, especially for, you know, a fantasy novel. Because, you know, I have flying creatures and monsters and teleporting doors. The characters have to be almost extra real.
Yeah. That was something that you said that was really interesting, too, is that they have to be grounded in reality mm-hmm. because, like, you used the example of Buffy the Vampire
Precisely.
Slayer.
Precisely. Buffy's characters had to be super grounded in reality because she's killing vampires. And so, you know, when Buffy's mother, I think, dies of a massive aneurysm, it's super tragic, but it's also super real.
Right.
And you can't walk away from it. And I believe the same thing when you're writing monsters and creatures and things that go bump in the dark. There has to be a believability. There has to be a verisimilitude. Ultimately, these are still people trying to move in the world and doing it very badly.
Yeah. Well, the book is excellent. I mean, it is. It's a commitment, but I think it's a commitment that everybody should make because it's really excellent. I'm looking forward to the next two.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Our next guest tonight is a very talented author whose beautiful debut novel, Golden Child, is available now. Please welcome to the show, Claire Adam, everyone. Hi, Claire. Hi. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This
is great.
Book is, it's beautiful. It is, there are parts of it that are very exciting. It is haunting. It takes place in Trinidad. You were from there.
Yes.
And you have said, I've heard you say that it is inspired a bit by, obviously, your upbringing there. Yes. How so?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of overlaps just a little bit with my family story. So I was born in Trinidad, and I lived there until I was 18. I was the youngest of four kids. And so when I was growing up there, it was sort of during the 80s and 90s, and we were having a recession in Trinidad at the time. So a lot of people were trying to emigrate. So amongst my family, we were all quite smart, quite academic. So, like, I guess my parents sort of had this idea for us that we would all go to universities in North America. And so, yeah, we just had to work very hard and study and get into these great schools and hopefully get scholarships.
It is, education does serve as sort of the escape for these children in this book. And, and it also the sort of oppressive idea of, like, having to succeed enough to achieve that escape. Mm. How did your mother is Irish?
That's right.
And your father's from Trinidad. How did they meet?
Yeah, so they were both doctors. And so my mom had, she'd come from Ireland and my dad had come from Trinidad, and they were both working in a hospital together in, I think it was in Nottingham. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, so there's all these, you know, in the doctor's mess room, they were playing cards, like, I don't know if they're looking after patients or what. Yeah. But yeah, so I think, you know, romance happens in these places.
How do they feel about having two doctors having a writer for a daughter?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're quite excited about it. So, like, we all kind of did science. So I did science originally. I did physics, and my siblings all did science as well. So, yeah, so I did the physics at college, and then, you know, physics was very hard. And, and, you know, I'd always sort of had this idea of writing as well. So after I finished college, you know, I just thought, okay, I think now is my time, and I...
And your siblings, is it true your siblings were nervous when they heard you were writing a book?
Well, a little bit, because they knew it was set in Trinidad, and they knew it was about these, you know, kids who have to work very hard, and they're sort of looking for their ticket out and the scholarship. And they were, each of them were kind of like, is it about me? Yeah. I was like, no, it's going to be okay. And they were like, oh, my gosh. And so, actually, I didn't let them read it until it was kind of, you know, until I sort of had the nearly finished draft.
It was too late. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're like, sorry, it already came back from the printers.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, here you go. Yeah, that's right.
And you went to, you ended up going to Brown, and you said that you were the youngest. And is it your parents were a little over the idea of moving their kids into dorms?
Yeah, well, so it was, I mean, I was the youngest. So, you know, my mom went with my brother and dropped him off at college. And this is like a flight from Trinidad, so it's a whole big deal. And then she went with my sister, and then she went with my other sister. And then when it came time to me, she was like, just go. You can handle it. So yeah, actually, one of my older sisters took me along and kind of dropped me off. And they're like, okay, there's where you kind of, you know, go to the bank, and that's where you put in some paperwork. Okay, see ya.
So like, and coming from Trinidad to Rhode Island, I imagine first time you saw snow, is
yeah,
that safe?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, in Trinidad, obviously, we're a tropical island. You know, our temperatures are like, you know, sort of 30 degrees Celsius, whatever that is in Fahrenheit. So, you know, I had never seen snow before. And so, yeah, so that was one of the really exciting things. So actually, I think it was, I suppose it would have been November, December by the time it first happened. But yeah, I had made friends with a couple of people from the tropics. And when it first started to snow, we all went out in our pajamas and did like our snow dance. We were like taking pictures. So yeah,
I'm
so
sure
it was good
most
fun.
Of the people in Providence, Rhode Island was like, who are these lunatics?
I know, yeah. I know. But for us, it was exciting.
Sarah Jessica Parker has been on the show talking about, she has her own imprint with Hogarth, which is the publisher.
Yeah.
And you guys have been doing a lot of press together. And I heard that the part that makes you nervous is not being around her. What's the worst part?
Well, I know. I mean, she is just so warm and lovely.
She's,
she's
the best.
Really, she's lovely. But, you know, she's a very stylish and fashionable lady. And, you know, us writers, we don't get out very much. And so, you know, I wear, like, my pajamas and, like, my, you know, coffee stains. And I'm like, oh, my God. So, you know, I sort of did quite a lot of shopping, you know, before I came on this trip. But, I mean, this is what I ended. This is my best effort, guys.
There's a real balance in this book. Reading it, there was a part of me that wanted to go to Trinidad. You obviously write about how beautiful it is, but it also, you know, as you mentioned, this is takes place in a really fraught time. There is this threat of violence that hangs over the book. Is that a thing that is hard to balance when you're writing, or does it just come naturally because you were there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I had a perfectly easygoing childhood, and, like, we kept our doors unlocked, and, like, you know, people moved around very freely, so... But it is one of, you know, it is one of the sort of features of life in Trinidad. I mean, people work and they go to school and they do everything normally, but yet there is this sort of, you know, quite violent crime that sort of happens side by side with everyday life. So, yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess when I was writing, I was trying hard not to sort of sensationalize it. I didn't want it to be like, this is some kind of war zone. It is not a war zone. It's just, you know, it's just one of these things that people have to kind of deal with in their everyday lives.
I'm always interested about this part of the process because this is a book that, as it sort of races to its conclusion, as a reader, I was very much, you know, turning each page, wondering what was going to happen. Did you, when you set out, did you know what was going to happen? Did you know how your book was going to conclude?
Yeah, I mean, I did know some of the big brushstrokes. Like, I sort of knew the big ending. But I mean, lots of things I had to work out along the way. Like, I knew the father, Clyde, very well. I had a very clear picture of him. but all the other characters I had to sort of write to discover. And like Paul, so there's twin boys in the story. There's Peter and Paul, and Paul is the one who's sort of less sort of recognized by his father, and you know, perhaps not his father's favorite. And so Clyde sort of overlooks him, and I think that I kind of overlooked him too when I was writing. So he was the one who kind of came last when I was writing
well,
it out.
Well, I'm happy to say you definitely figured it out, and I really enjoyed the book. And thank you so much for being here. Such a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Claire Adam, everybody. Golden Child is available where books are sold.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with Claire Adam, author of The Golden Child. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you spoke to Seth on the show about growing up in Trinidad. Mm. You told me that your parents no longer live there, though. Mm. Everyone sort of moved away.
Yeah, that's right. Well, because so out of all the four kids, so we all left, you know, we went to North America and then wandered away in our different directions. And yeah, so they were, you know, they're kind of like, well, where are all our children? So yeah, so they've recently moved up to London because my mom, as I said, is Irish. And so a lot of her family are in Ireland and she wanted to be closer to them. So yeah, so it was only quite recent though that they moved.
And they're close to your kids as well now.
Yeah, so that's great. So my kids finally get to see their grandparents, and yeah, which is something they hadn't had before. So yeah, that's sort of, it's been a big treat for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also mentioned to me that you had expectations about the length of time that it might take you to write this.
That's right. I know. Well, because I thought this would be easy. Like, so I really started writing seriously when I had the kids and I was working in this sort of science charity job. And I was like, okay, look, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to write my novel. I thought it would take like 1 year. And little did I know. So, yes, I mean, it sort of took 5 years for this novel. But I mean, it, you know, I had two other novels that that I worked on and put aside before this. So it's probably a little bit more than 5 years altogether. But yeah, so little did I know how hard it would be.
Mm-hmm. And did you find certain times were better for you to write than others?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a night owl, so if I could work at night, I mean, man, I could get so much done. But, you know, I mean, that's just not how life works. You know, the kids, like, you know, now they're a bit older, so they can kind of get their own breakfasts. But like when there was some, of course, kids get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. So you just have to kind of work when you can. So like when they were small, it was all like pushing them around in the buggy. And when they fall asleep, you kind of whip open the computer and you sort of try and type your 1,000 words. And so, yeah, it's been a challenge.
One of the other things that we talked about was how well this book has been received. I mean, Seth loved it. I spoke to him about it, and I loved it as well. Now that it's out in the world and no longer just yours, what do you hope people walk away from it thinking?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think like when you're writing, you don't sort of think about that side of things. You just write the book that you kind of have in your mind. But I mean, you know, I guess a couple of things. I guess that, you know, obviously it's set in Trinidad, which is where I'm from. So it's very familiar to me. But I realize that, you know, it'll be a new place for many readers. So, you know, so if people sort of come away with a sort of a new understanding of what it's like to live in a different place, that's, you know, that's certainly very satisfying. Yeah, I mean, obviously the characters in this novel, you know, they have to make sometimes quite huge sacrifices. One of the themes is sort of to do with the, you know, the vital importance of education and sort of a route to a better life. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's always good if people can, well, people will read what they want into it, but
see another perspective. Mm, yeah. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned, I mean, you just mentioned the idea of not realizing or not thinking about how people might perceive it while you were writing it. Mm-hmm. You said to me that you also didn't think about the fact that you were a parent while you were writing it.
That's right. Yes. I mean, you know, in this book, there's, you know, it focuses quite closely on the father and his two children. And, you know, like when we meet the boys, they're 13, but then, you know, we do sort of follow them through their childhood. And, you know, I mean, I have children myself, obviously, but yeah, no, I didn't sort of think about it as sort of writing as a mom. I mean, I was very sort of absorbed in Clyde's, who's the father. I was very absorbed in his point of view. So I kind of saw what he saw and also didn't see what things he didn't see, the things that he overlooks, I overlooked also. Yeah. So that's kind of how it was. Yeah. So I wasn't sort of thinking, I mean, I think I couldn't have been thinking about my own children, you know, but also as an author, you have to put yourself aside, you know, you have to kind of erase yourself out of the book. Like, it's not about me. It's about these characters.
Yeah. Well, you did a wonderful job. I loved it. And thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much. This is so much fun.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Mm.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.